historically speaking, these guilds would have the senior level of the regiment. So you'd have the CO, colonel of regiment, 2IC type thing, and then you'd have a bunch of sergeant majors in the RSM. And it didn't really allow for long-term exposure. These folks would do 2 to 3 years tops. They'd be promoted out, go do different things. So you're basically running a machine that's only going to have that skill set for 2 years, and then you're dropping somebody else in. They've got to ramp up to speed. So if you start at an early age and you bring it through that whole process, now you're training something that really, it's like a perpetual motion machine. It's going to work. And they spend time with my group, which is the Friends of the Regiment, so they learn who those folks are outside of the directive regimental family that they can rely on and build relationships with as well. And what's interesting about it, one of our friends of the regiment who has been active in this regiment since 2009, Covell Brown, who's a very good friend of mine, his son now is getting involved. So when you look at that, now we're in the second generation of this. My son is now just he's finished his first year at RMC.
Congratulations.
And it's great. You know what? And now he's going into a second year. You know, fingers crossed he'll be a dragoon because he wants to stay in the Armored Corps. We'll see what the sorting hat says down the road, but you know what? Hopefully it works out. And, you know, so there's a generational turn there. So, you know, what was started in 2004 is now moving into its, you know, its evolution, and it's moving into its secondary turn from its outside supporters as well. So it's when you look at this as a success, that's the success. It's not the success that we're able to raise the money or that we're able to make it work. I mean, those are tactical problems, and they're solvable. It just takes a commitment, a focus, a plan, and we got to execute it. The execution is always a tough thing, but it works if you put your energy into it. What really is the icing on the cake is the fact that, you know what, the younger people that had nothing to do with the original setup now understand it, and they're moving into that space, and they're developing it, and they're bringing their own ideas to the table, which is working. It's not just about me anymore. Or what the Friends are doing, or what the SEAL's doing, or the RSM.
I want to mention to all of the listeners today who are tuning in to this interview that a lot of the work that you've done in terms of serving in the military and also dedicating a countless amount of time towards helping the Canadian Armed Forces is certainly impressive. And I want to applaud you on all of your work. I think that it's so important for those who are interested in making a difference to pursue their dreams, to receive advice from those who are knowledgeable in, you know, perhaps fundraising, perhaps dedicating their time towards volunteer work. And with your background, you've committed so much time towards not only fundraising, but towards serving in the military and also...
I didn't make a career out of it. As a full-time profession, I was in it for a short period of time, but what I got out of that short term, I had, and I'm going to be biased here, I had the best leadership in the Canadian forces in that regiment. And I mean, it's living proof. Like Walt Natinchuk was a battle captain when I was a trooper, and you know, he became the CDS, right? So I had that unique ability of being around all those folks that were dealing with the nuts and bolts of day-to-day workings of that place. And you saw how they thought, and you saw how they solved problems, and they would explain things. Like, I could go up to the CO and I could say, you know, without being disrespectful, why did you make that decision? Not because I'm questioning it, but I want to know the methodology behind that process, because that gives me a better understanding about what we're trying to do here, even though that's not my responsibility at the time, or it was definitely not my rank or my role. That's just my curiosity, and they were generous enough to, you know, to explain it. And what it did is it allowed me, when I got out of school and started running businesses, to understand that that skill set that they were teaching had huge value on the outside world. And when I landed Home Depot, I was 26 years old, you know, a year and a half out of university. You don't land a $32 billion company a year and a half out of school on your own. Yeah, so I was 26 years old. I made a pitch. Now, it was a, you know, in today we call that a social media experiment because I played with a technology at the time that wasn't being used for commercial application. I saw huge value in it. I said, okay, I think we can do this. And then Home Depot had a big problem on their hand that they had to solve. And they had, you know, the mothership in Atlanta. They had regional offices all over North America. They deal with different seasonal client. They deal with different seasonal customer bases. That's, I guess, about the best way to describe it. So you're not selling a snowblower to somebody in Southern California, but at the same time, you're not selling somebody into New Jersey with that same product line. So they needed a way to have all their marketing materials and imagery and stuff like that pumped through a cranky old internet, because back then the internet was still pretty fragile, right? Like, it just, digital cameras took 1 meg files.
Wow.
The internet should shoot an email, but you couldn't really upload anything bigger than, you know, a 100K JPEG file. But you could create concept work and you could ship it in real time. And that was a game changer for the advertising industry. No one was doing that at that level. And most of the big industries were all shooting still film, and they were doing things in an analog way, and it was timely and it was expensive. And when you go to a company that has a $32 billion a year sales budget and you say, I'm going to save you, let's say, 2% of that top money, that's big money. And they can do a lot more with that savings of that 2% to do other things that it wouldn't normally be able to do. So they're interested in it. So, you know, if it wasn't for my time in the CF, there's no way I would have had the leadership and management skills at that age to do it, because it was a shit show. I mean, I had hiring people to run a business. I didn't come out of Harvard or anything like that. It was a crazy time in the industry, and it was growing so fast for them, and we were doing everything we could to try to hang on to that tail while these guys were the clients were racing off. And then you start picking up a pile of other clients and businesses, because the spinoff effect of having somebody that big is huge, right? So that built my company. So I owe those guys, you know, indirectly, directly, you know, call it the, you know, whatever it is, I owed that regiment something for the time and the energy that they invested in me at a very early age. It made sense to give something back. But, you know, that's enough about me. There's a lot of really good people out there right now doing stuff for the CF. You know, Blake Goldring does a huge amount of work with Canada Company. There's a pile of other people out there that are giving huge amounts of their time, resources, and energy to the Canadian Forces. And, you know, if we have to thank anybody, I think you have to thank Rick Hillier. Because Rick took it all, threw it against the wall. He could have easily been fired, no problem at all. It got gonzo. Paul Martin took enough trust in him to say, you know what, I think you're the right guy for the job, and we need this. And General Hillier moved the bar forward for a lot of people like myself to be able to have that sense of opportunity to give something back. So, you know, if we're going to thank anybody, we really have to make sure, you know, we give credit to him, because he was the catalyst for a lot of changes that happened inside that box and outside with the community itself. Like, that, you know, giving Canadians a chance to feel proud about their Canadian Forces. I mean, there were times when I was serving that I was told not to wear a uniform out in the general public. I mean, that's atrocious. The mindset of the 1980s based on what was going on at the time. And it's, everything's a learning curve, right? You know, we could play the blame game, but that's just not fair. And who knows what those challenges were that some of the folks were dealing with back then that were making those leadership decisions that we would say today, that was an unfortunate decision, but we don't know the background to it. So it is what it is, and that's what it was. But Rick was able to take that and move that hugely forward in a big way. And it helped that the Americans were asking us to join them in the Afghanistan war. It was smart that we did that, you know, and that gained us a lot of credibility, and it tuned us up in a way that we were able to, I think, not only make a difference for the Canadian Forces, but we made a relevant difference for Canada, because at that point we were able to negotiate certain things with the Americans in a way that was very influential for Canada, because we were supporting the Americans in one of their conflict zones and they needed our support.
I also want to ask you another question pertaining to some of the funds that you were able to raise with
Sure.
your team and some of the money that you and your crew have raised over the past 10 years have gone towards a host of things, including supplying wounded soldiers with clothing, hospital kits, and many other items to help provide a more home-type atmosphere while they recover overseas. Please tell us more about the significance
okay.
and the impact of your contributions,
well,
along with how more people can become members or affiliated with your crew.
Well, you know, the one thing I would say which is great about Canadians in general is Canadians love to help,
yes.
right? So it's just a question of, the biggest challenge getting Canadians involved in something like this is, the biggest question is, how do I get involved, right? They want to get involved, but where's the mechanism in place that allows them to get involved? So the outreach that's being done now, let's say from the CF in general, is much more impactful than what it was 10, 15 years ago. And people understand how to do it, and there's mechanisms in place now where people can get directly involved. So to go back to the soldiers' kits and some like that, those are moments in time. We're actively at war, we're in Afghanistan, our troops are getting injured, it becomes a quality of life issue, our troops are making the ultimate sacrifice, they're getting killed, it becomes a quality of life issue for their families. So really what you're trying to do is build a mechanism that can support the members of our families and look after them in ways that is outside of the mandate of what the government of Canada is capable of doing at that moment in time. So, you know, the government of Canada had great resources put in place to look after members of the Canadian forces, but you can always do more. So the guild, for instance, within our regiment, we would collectively sit down as a board of directors and decide what those needs are, those immediate needs are at that moment in time that would allow comfort to the soldiers and their families beyond what they're currently getting at that moment in time. So some of it's situational based on the moment in time, and those needs are collectively decided upon. It has nothing to do with me. That's the regimental family and the board of directors and the guild that collectively decide what's best for the families, and everybody has an active input on that. And then we use mechanisms through, let's say, the patron of the regiment, which is my role, which connects to the friends of the regiment, and we can go out and we can tap the private sector and people that want to support us directly into raising funds or, you know, doing humanitarian things. I mean, one of our great friends of the regiment, Ted Averbrook, took two wounded soldiers. He threw the concept together, and we raised enough money to take two wounded soldiers from our regiment to South Africa to do a battlefield tour of Lilyfontein, which the regiment won 3 Victoria Crosses in that battle alone. It's crazy. And then harvested a springbok to bring back to the regiment. So, you know, people would actually have an idea of what this animal looks like, life size, you know, and it sits in, you know, the regimental entranceway right beside the guidon. It holds a huge significance to this, and it changed the lives of those two soldiers. You know, they were badly wounded. Morale is in the shitter because they can't get back to the regiment and do the kind of soldiering that they would have loved to have done. It's based on recovery, and everybody's body heals differently, and there's a psychological impact that is devastating to it too. Both those soldiers were fantastic, strong individuals, and one of them I still stay in touch with. Actually, I was talking to him yesterday on the phone. You know, we go hunting together, we drive motorcycles together. I mean, he's part of my family, I'm part of his family, and, you know, that would have never have happened without Ted deciding to do something crazy, like, let's take a couple of wounded soldiers to South Africa and go and do this. So that's just one thing. I mean, we have other friends of the regiment decide that always make sure that, you know, the guys come out and go to golf tournaments and the Veterans Days. And, you know, we had a Blue Jays thing where our color guard was on the parade for the game on July the 1st for Canada Day. You know, and we had to get extra money and extra tickets for some of the folks that just couldn't, you know, we didn't have the resources for them to be there. So guess what? We need to raise that externally. And, you know, again, Nicholas Brown steps up to the plate because he knows somebody at City TV. You know, and the next thing you know, Roger Peterson is playing into this thing, and he's giving tickets to, based on his relationship with Nicholas, which helps out the Guild, which now helps out the Dragoons, which now helps out, you know, Sergeant Major Sampson and his family. And so this is kind of how this network works, right? So it's a grassroots, small, very close network of people that are well-focused, that do fantastic work. Mm-hmm. And stay supported. Like one of our friends that just retired off the boards, Jeff Marins. I mean, Jeff was actively involved in that regiment for over 10 years, donated, I would say, well in excess of $300,000 of his time and money to build a historic vehicle collection for the regiment that's unique. And that was completely by his own volition, decided that he wanted to get involved with this. This is what he was going to do. And that was based on a relationship that he had with Sean Murray, who was another friend of the regiment from the early days in the beginning. And Sean was very influential and a huge catalyst. And he actually got Rick Hillier to have a dinner at his house, I think it was in 2005. And that's where we brought the first group of people in to say, this is the Royal Canadian Dragoons. This is what an armored regiment looks like. This is who we are. and we need help.